From Seattle, this is World Trade Watch on day four of the WTO summit. On today's program,
protests continue despite escalating police tactics. We'll have an eyewitness report.
An oil activist from Ecuador talks about how the WTO will impact the environment and indigenous rights.
We'll have an in-depth account of Cargill Corporation and genetically modified crops.
And reaction to Clinton's address to WTO delegates.
Also, a look at proposals that threaten the world's forests.
All this and more coming up on World Trade Watch. First, these headlines.
In Seattle, I'm Philip Babich with these news headlines. The air tastes of pepper spray, eyes are stinging from tear gas, the drone of helicopters overhead has become background noise. In the core business district, authorities have clamped down hard, lining street after street with police suited up in riot gear, and soldiers from the National Guard wearing camouflage combat fatigues. Rows of hulking figures wearing black armor, helmets and gas masks are brandishing heavy batons. Welcome to downtown Seattle. Eager to enforce a no-protest zone, top officials have extended provisions of a nighttime curfew. Police and soldiers are excluding unauthorized persons from dozens of blocks. The apparent aim is to shut down the protests. Sometimes the police actions have been drastic, moving in quickly to make arrests at the slightest sign of protest. Among those arrested was Victor Minotti of the International Forum on Globalization, a non-governmental organization. According to witnesses, police rushed through a small crowd to get to Minotti, who was standing a few blocks from the ministerial after meeting with environmental NGOs and two White House officials. Anuradha Mittal, policy director of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, described the incident.
He saw me, waved at me and said, "Hey, I've just come out from the USTR meetings and the people you're with, you might want to call them. Let me tell you what's happening inside." And already there was lots of cops there and there were about 50, 60 people who are already there. But anyway, Victor raised his voice slightly, which at best could be heard by 4 or 5 people because of so much noise. Suddenly, about 15 policemen marched down. There's suddenly a stampede as if a riot has broken out. And before my eyes, before I could do anything, I see Victor Minotti, only him being picked out of the whole group and being taken away by the police, marched down. And the rest of the cops moved into formal lines, so none of us could go after and ask them what he was being arrested for.
The protests in Seattle this week have helped forge some burgeoning alliances among various groups. A high-spirited rally in March, sponsored by organized labor that began at Seattle's waterfront, was evidence of this. The over 20,000 participants included many union members marching with young students and silver-haired activists, environmentalists, and timber workers. Scott Paul, spokesperson for the environmental group Greenpeace, stood holding a large helium float and explained his group's position.
Well, essentially our message, as you can read on the side of this 40-foot condom, is for the WTO to practice safe trade. For the last 20 years at the intergovernmental level and at the national level, we've created international treaties and domestic laws to protect the environment, jobs, our health. And all this is at stake right now within the free trade talks taking place within the WTO.
Right across the intersection from Paul stood two timber workers from Aberdeen, Washington, who talked about the same issues in their own way.
We're in the timber business, loggers, and he's a contract forester. So we a little different than a lot of people's outlooks here, I guess you'd say.
Fair trade. That's the bottom line. It needs to be free trade, but fair trade, and not exploiting down to the lowest common denominator.
While most of the WTO delegates are staying in Seattle's finest hotels, homeless people and many low-income protesters from out of town are without a place to stay. Anticipating this problem, Seattle City Council member Nick Licata proposed opening up unused city buildings to provide shelter.
Why can't the city do an honest assessment of what they can do to at least provide some minimal shelter, a floor and a roof? The opposition I got from within the city bureaucracy was that if we did that, then it would be putting out a welcome mat.
Despite Licata's failed plan, dozens of anti-WTO activists, took matters into their own hands and occupied a four-story abandoned apartment building in Seattle city center. One of the squatters, who wished to be identified only as Anne, says that this direct action is part of an effort to rethink the concept of private property and, in the process, create community.
I'm here because I believe that housing is a right and not a privilege. We're here to protest corporate greed in all its manifestations.
Those are the news headlines. For World Trade Watch, I'm Philip Babich in Seattle.
Third day in a row, national news reports are filled with vivid images of protesters and police confronting each other in central areas of Seattle. Since Wednesday, National Guard troops have also taken up positions downtown. For an on-the-ground perspective from an organizer of ongoing demonstrations, we turn to Celia Alario, a nonviolent direct action trainer for the Ruckus Society. She joins us in studio. Welcome to World Trade Watch.
Thank you.
Well, the government has quite literally called in the troops. You're up against what you could call massive firepower, armored personnel vehicles, tear gas, pepper spray, concussion grenades. To what extent has this militarized response, you think, been successful in shutting down the demonstrations?
I don't think it's at all broken the morale or the spirit of the thousands of people who remain in Seattle this week, whether they're international citizens looking at indigenous rights, environmental rights, or labor rights. These people have come together and I believe are going to stay strong even in the face of this incredible show of force. It's remarkable to watch hundreds of people remain calm, peaceful, and continue to sing sometimes the national anthem or My Country, 'Tis of Thee or other songs like that in the face of incredible violence. You know, the more than 400 people who were arrested yesterday peacefully protesting are still being held at this time. They've not been, many of them have not been given food, water, some in critical need of medical attention and have been not receiving that, and also have not even had an opportunity to have discussions with their lawyers or other legal representatives. And yet their spirit and their solidarity is very strong at Sandpoint where they're being held right now.
And stepping back, kind of an overview, what is the significance of all this? I mean, if you were to summarize the meaning of the last 72 hours, what does it mean in political, social, and ethical terms?
What I have seen is an incredible coming together of people from a diverse array of social, economic, cultural backgrounds, people who work on a variety of issues, who all recognize that the WTO is undemocratic, does not represent them, and is a threat to everything we hold dear, from the air we breathe and our children's future to the fundamental rights of workers in the workplace, what have you. What I have seen and what I think I'm seeing out on the streets of Seattle is really the stripping away of an illusion that we live in a civil society and a democratic society in the United States. And what I am seeing instead is what is really essentially martial law. Our constitutional freedoms are being systematically stripped away within a small area downtown so that the delegates and others can try to have a meeting. I think that the message that will go out to the world is that this is a situation where there are, regardless of whether the meetings continue or the meetings are shut down, whether the delegates all end up in the same room or not, the entire world population is going to understand now that there is something called the World Trade Organization and understand a little bit about who they are and how left out of that process they are. And what I think will happen is that people around the world, ordinary people who just want to have a nice life, are going to be moved into action and catalyzed by what the brave folks in the streets are doing in Seattle right now.
Celia, you've spent the last couple of days out in the streets. You want to sort of give us a flavor of what's going on in the streets. This is all very decentralized. It's almost different what's going on from corner to corner in the downtown area. Can you describe particularly the last 24 hours or so of events in the streets?
Absolutely. You're right that it does vary from corner to corner. I was on corners where people were very festive, dancing in the streets, talking. Sometimes there were jugglers, clowns, what have you. And I've been on the very next corner a few minutes later and seen an absolutely outrageous and unwarranted show of force in terms of tear gas, pepper spray use, the firing of rubber bullets on people that are literally standing around, milling around, having conversations about important politics. I've seen crews of volunteer medics who are walking around with medical supplies be stopped, have their medical supplies seized from them and destroyed in front of them. I've heard accounts even of people who were treating innocent bystanders and Seattle citizens who were caught in the crossfire for pepper spray or tear gas and directly receiving tear gas in their faces in the middle of trying to treat a citizen.
Celia, you talked a moment about the message that was going to be sent out to the world. This is the first time the United States has hosted a WTO meeting, certainly an international organization like this meeting in the United States. What do you think the police response, which at this point is being run not by the Seattle Police Department, but certainly has been federalized and is a multi-agency federal operation, what message do you think the world will get about the way the United States has handled the protests and the police response to it?
I think that the message they're going to take away is that the federal agencies, including a number of other undercover cops who arrested people without identifying themselves yesterday, and the Seattle police, and the United States government have basically created a situation here to serve the needs of multinational corporations and the World Trade Organization. What we're seeing on the streets is a microcosm of the problems with the World Trade Organization. They have stripped away the fundamental freedoms. They were confiscating placards, for heaven's sakes, cardboard placards without sticks attached to them or anything. They were violating people's freedom of speech in the streets. They've made it unlawful for people to assemble. And, you know, other than folks taking sanctuary at the educational events in the church, anyone who wants to walk from event to event and learn about the issues is under siege. And I think the WTO, the World Trade Organization, wants to keep these global issues in the dark. And I think that as they start to come to light, as we've been seeing, unfortunately, the response is to try to quell that and to quell the resistance of the common folk before everybody recognizes how dangerous and absolutely out of control the World Trade Organization is.
Well, Celia, speaking of resistance, I wonder, from your perspective, we have people listening all over North America and beyond right now to your words. What would you or would you urge them to do in particular?
Absolutely. You know, I would say you don't have to be an activist to care about this issue. If you care about the safety of the food you eat, the air you breathe, your children's future, what kind of a job you're going to hold, what's happening to the environment, if you just care about sovereignty and the right of your own country to pass laws and make decisions, I would urge you to get educated and rise up in opposition to the World Trade Organization. I would like to see major cities and even small cities all around the country out in the streets today in solidarity with the nonviolent peaceful protesters in Seattle.
Okay, that's the voice of Celia Ilario. She's a nonviolent direct action trainer for the Ruckus Society, one of the groups involved in the ongoing nonviolent protests in Seattle against the World Trade Organization. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're so welcome.
Up next, oil and the WTO.
Environmental activists have been sounding the alarm at the WTO summit, charging that the organization could weaken environmental regulations around the globe. They frequently point to Venezuela's successful challenge to the U.S. Clean Air Act, which ruled that the regulation was an unfair barrier to Venezuelan oil exports, as one concrete example of how the WTO threatens the environment. Oil corporations are some of the most powerful in the world, and virtually all of them, from Shell and Chevron's role in Nigeria, to Unocal's in Burma, to Texaco's in Ecuador, have tarnished environmental and human rights records. Joining us now to look at the oil industry in the WTO are Elizabeth Bravo of Oil Watch Ecuador and Martin Wagner of Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund. Thank you both for joining us on World Trade Watch. Elizabeth, how do free trade policies impact the communities you work with in Ecuador, particularly in the Amazon?
Well, if we want to relate with oil activities, trade policies impact very much in the sense that in the WTO, each country have to produce what is better. In terms of economics, not what is better for the country, not in terms of food security, not in terms of survival, but in terms of global market. So, for instance, Ecuador have oil in the Amazon. And it's also the home place of many indigenous people who have been living traditionally for thousands of years. So with all these trade agreements, the people have to stop living traditionally, and the lands are occupied by oil companies. And this is the case of Texaco.
Well, tell us a little bit about what Texaco is doing in the Amazon.
Well, Texaco left the Amazon in 1990, but it was there for 30 years. And they occupy the Amazon, which was, in a way, a remote area. There was only indigenous people living very traditionally. And suddenly the company came and they said to the indigenous, you are not allowed to move from here. You are not allowed to move from the river because now this is our land. And they begin to open wells, they begin to open roads. And indigenous were pushed to very small territories. Their land for hunting and fishing was transformed into oil fields. And then with the oil companies, new settlers came and occupied the indigenous territories. And, of course, now both settlers and indigenous people don't have water to drink because all the water is contaminated. Because even Texaco left Ecuador, the technology remains. And they left a very old technology in the Amazon.
Being here in Seattle this week, I wonder what kind of awareness you sense exists from other parts of the world about the situation that you're describing.
Well, I haven't had the chance to speak about these issues very much here in Seattle because I think everyone is very busy with the WTO thing. But for me, being here in Seattle has been a very exciting experience indeed to see how many people are opposing to the trade to the new trade rules, and how in this country, which usually these sort of things are not happening, they are all together, very different groups, fighting for the same reason, which is stop the rules of trade over the rules of sovereignty, over the rules of food security, over the rules of justice and environment.
And when you learn about events in places like Nigeria involving the rights of indigenous people and conflicts with oil cartels and so forth, has that been part of a process of connections with people in similar situations? I wanted to ask about the kind of international. We know that the oil companies are very organized internationally. What about the resistance to them?
Yes. Well, I am part of Oil Watch. Oil Watch is a southern network. With organizations in different countries, in tropics, facing similar problems. So we have members from Nigeria and many of the countries that it was mentioned, like Colombia, Venezuela, Burma, Thailand, Indonesia. And the idea is to have, like the corporations are organized through the world, also the people who are facing similar problems, we are beginning to organize ourselves to share our experience, because sharing experience is very important. When one indigenous community come in contact with another indigenous communities and they know how they are resisting, this is a very powerful tool for the communities.
That's Elizabeth Bravo. She's with Oil Watch Ecuador, as she just mentioned. Martin Wagner of the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund, let's bring you into this discussion. The one ruling regarding oil that everyone always points to in this country, of course, is the Venezuelan oil company's challenge to the Clean Air Act in this country, which literally affects the air we breathe. Can you talk a little bit about the specifics of that and your involvement in that?
Absolutely. The United States Clean Air Act, as amended in 1990, required cleaning up of the gasoline that is sold in certain parts of the United States where the air quality is particularly bad. The U.S. EPA, which was required to implement that law, decided that in order to do so and ensure that clean gasoline came in from foreign refiners, it had to treat foreign refiners slightly differently than it treated domestic refiners because the records about what the pollutants in the gasoline were different for foreign refiners. So it found that in order to protect the clean air in the United States, it had to treat these foreign refiners differently. Venezuela and Brazil, as you mentioned, are very powerful oil exporters to the United States, and they challenged that rule of the EPA at the WTO. The United States argued that this rule was necessary to protect the clean air, and there's supposed to be an exception in the WTO rules that allows you to protect those kinds of exhaustible resources. But the WTO nevertheless found that this difference of treatment between Venezuela and Brazil and the United States refiners violated the WTO rules. As a result, EPA basically rolled right over and changed its rules, even though at the same time it found that it still had some concerns about whether if it changed its rules it would really be able to ensure that gasoline that came into the United States was clean.
The other WTO ruling that deals with human rights violations, because of course the oil giants are involved in both environmental violations and alleged complicity in human rights violations, of course, is the Massachusetts Burma sanctions, which were overturned by the WTO, and UNICAL has been accused of complicity with horrendous violations like forced labor, forced relocation in Burma. Can you talk about the implications of that as well?
Well, I want to clarify that those regulations have not been overturned by the WTO yet. There was a threat of a challenge at the WTO. And I think this shows what the power of the WTO is. One of the reasons the United States actually has brought action against Massachusetts for these regulations is because of its fear that it will be sanctioned by the WTO. So what this shows is we don't even need to get national action before the WTO rules create a sense of fear in nations so that they won't take action to protect the environment or human rights. But when you mention human rights, I think it brings us back to the case that Elizabeth was talking about in Texaco. I've been involved in a suit trying to apply international law in U.S. courts against Texaco. One of the factual bases of that case is that Texaco, from the very outset of its activities in the Amazon, was discharging toxic wastes straight into the surface water, straight into the rivers and lakes in Ecuador. At the very time that it began that practice, it was arguing to Congress, to the U.S. Congress, that it did not need to be regulated by the United States to prevent it to do that in the United States because this was already the practice in the United States, and all the state courts states in the United States since the early 1900s have prohibited this kind of practice. So Texaco was going to Ecuador and using standards that polluted the environment that it would never have used in the United States.
Well, question for both of you. In the debates about the World Trade Organization, the opponents of the WTO have invoked the name of sovereignty, national sovereignty. At the same time, it seems that there's a parallel question of sovereignty within nations, particularly the rights of indigenous people who may be up against the international structures of the WTO or international multinational corporations, but are also suffering from the repression of the national government. I wonder how those two parallel issues of sovereignty play out.
Mm-hmm. Well, the WTO is against the sovereignty of the countries because the rules of the WTO go against the constitution of the countries, which is the maximum law. So it's but it should violate the sovereignty rights of the countries. Now, within the several countries, there are violations of indigenous rights, collective rights. But I think this is a matter, internal matter. I know that the rights of the indigenous people in Ecuador are violated. And I think this is a problem of the Ecuadorian people, and we have to deal with this problem. We cannot put this problem internationally, because when you put the problems of national sovereignty in the international arena, then you can call this imperialism. So I think we are speaking about two things. I had to defend the sovereignty right of my country, and I had to oppose the rules of the WTO and how the WTO is attempting the sovereignty right of my country. And I also have an internal fight when the government is violating the collective rights of the indigenous people. But we shouldn't mix both things together.
I think there's another point there, which is, as you suggest, indigenous peoples are somewhat separate from the nations even that they live in. They have a certain level of sovereignty of their own. And yet in the present international regime, we rely on nations, governments, to protect the sovereignty and the rights of indigenous peoples. One of the problems with the WTO and the concerns that Elizabeth was just raising is that it does create a system where governments have even less incentive to protect the rights of indigenous peoples. You know, one of the arguments that Texaco has made in that case is they weren't violating any Ecuadorian laws at the time when they were discharging these pollutants into the waters. Mm. And that's really a ridiculous argument, because Texaco, the situation, the negotiations between Texaco and Ecuador were not arm's-length negotiations. They were not equal bargaining powers. Ecuador desperately needs the kind of money that Texaco offers. And Texaco comes in and says, we'll give you that money as long as you don't require us to comply with any strict environmental standards. And by doing that, Texaco is essentially destroying the sovereignty and the sovereign obligation of Ecuador to protect the rights of its indigenous peoples.
Elizabeth, what about international attempts to set environmental regulations like the Kyoto Protocol that often work through the United Nations and other organizations to set protocols and agreements, whether be it on the Kyoto Protocol against greenhouse emissions to deal with global warming, whether it's on biodiversity? How does the WTO challenge those and perhaps overrule and trump them?
Well, the WTO have a lot of contradiction with the environmental conventions. And I would like to mention, for instance, the Convention of Biological Diversity that I know more than the Kyoto Convention. For instance, in the Convention of Biological Diversity, there is the Article 8G, who speak about the rights of indigenous people and the right to promote the traditional practices of the people. The WTO, of course, is breaking this possibility by, for instance, the transnationals come to a country like Ecuador with very high biodiversity, take the plants, patent the plants, and now we are discussing also the TRIPS agreements, which allowed patenting on life. So there is a very big contradiction between these two agreements, the Biodiversity Convention and the WTO Convention.
Martin, what does that do as your ability as an international lawyer to challenge some of these corporations in either in U.S. courts or internationally?
Well, one of the problems when you raise a multilateral environmental agreement like the Kyoto Protocol is that it is completely unresolved what exactly will be the relationship, which will trump. Will it be the WTO rules or will it be these environmental rules? And one of the difficulties is that actions that governments take under these environmental agreements are government actions. And those actions can be challenged by other countries under the WTO rules. And so far, we've seen that every environmental challenge at the WTO has come out in the favor of corporations.
Okay, Elizabeth Bravo is with Oil Watch Ecuador. Martin Wagner is with the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund. Thank you both for joining us. I'm Julie Light with Norbert Solomon. You're listening to World Trade Watch, a co-production of the National Radio Project, Corporate Watch, and the Institute for Public Accuracy. For more information about this series or for tapes or transcripts, call 1-800-529-5736. Call that same number for a free information packet or to get in touch with our guests. Again, that's 800-529-5736. You can also find us on the internet at www.corpwatch.org or www.radioproject.org.
You're listening to World Trade Watch with Julie Light. I'm Norman Solomon. Straight ahead, the power of agribusiness and the perils to the forests. But first, President Clinton addressed the World Trade Organization and told delegates that opening foreign markets would lead to a more peaceful world.
I'm sure everyone in this room has been struck by the cruel irony that in this most modern of ages, that the biggest problems of human societies are the oldest ones, those rooted in our fear of those who are different from us, different races, different ethnic groups, different tribes, different religions, all over the world, people consumed by differences. When people are working together for common prosperity in a rule-based system, they have big incentives to lay the differences down and join hands to work together. The world is a better place than it would have been had we not had the last 50 years of increasing economic cooperation for trade and investment. The world of the future will be a safer place if we continue to work together in a rule-based system that offers enormous incentives for people to find ways to cooperate and to give up their old hatreds and their impulses to violence and war.
Joining us in the studio now is Deborah Toler, a specialist in global political economy and an analyst for World Trade Watch Radio throughout this week. And also with us is Scott Nova, a policy analyst with Public Citizen. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, we just heard President Clinton saying here in Seattle people need to curb their impulses to violence and war. What we've heard on the streets is people demanding a curb to institutions of violence and war. I wonder how you feel the events here in Seattle at the WTO summit will play out in the weeks and months ahead. What does this foreshadow? What possibilities exist as a result of what's happened here?
Well, I think that I've been attending a lot of the forums that have focused on groups from Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And it's been very interesting to see how they have, on the one hand, been sorry to see that there's been, you know, some breaking of windows and fire, etc. But they've been very struck by the images of the Seattle Police Department sort of lined up like a, you know, science fiction war movie, moving in, you know, just lockstep hitting their boots. That whole image is something that America has been telling them this true of their countries, but is not true of a democratic system. And so they're struck by the irony. It's an image that they're going to take back to their countries and talk about. You know, America is telling us about how to set up democracy and how to do this and how not to be corrupt, and yet they have, you know, their police guarding Nike and Gap. So that's one thing that's going to be played out. I think that although it's very sad that the violence has somewhat taken over the story that many organizations like Scott's wanted to get out, it has nonetheless gotten the word WTO in the American lexicon, and I can foresee the possibility of that playing out in next year's presidential election.
Scott Nova, the American political lexicon, what does WTO mean now?
Well, I think there is, in part as a result of the events in Seattle this week, a recognition far more broadly on the part of the American public, not just in a general sense, that our nation's trade policy and the international trading system are not representing the interests of ordinary workers, but a more specific knowledge of the way the WTO as an institution is functioning as a tool of powerful interests in the United States and around the world. And I think obviously it's up to the activists, the organizers, the public interest groups to build on that broader awareness as we move forward.
And what kind of coalition building? What sort of coalitions do you see in the offing?
Well, I think a lot of the media here in Seattle was struck and in some cases shocked by the breadth of the coalition represented here, from environmentalists walking hand in hand with steelworkers, farmers walking hand in hand with people primarily concerned about protecting endangered species, an enormous array of organizations and interests coming together to present a common message, which is that the institution, the WTO, is dominated by a narrow set of corporate interests that are running roughshod over the interests of the rest of us. And I think Seattle has served both to present to the world the breadth of the coalition, but also to strengthen that coalition through the common work that was done here.
Deborah, we have heard the Clinton administration throughout the week begin to adopt some of the rhetoric of protecting labor standards, environmental rights. Do you think that this is an attempt at co-optation, or do you think that this is really a measure of how much the protesters and the opposition has begun to move the agenda and the debate?
Well, I think that the protesters have moved the debate to the extent that they feel like they have to do some kind of make an attempt at co-optation, whereas before they didn't feel like they even had to do that. And my understanding, although I haven't been able to confirm this, and I want to emphasize that, but my understanding is that a number of major environmental groups and others have already, they held meetings with President Clinton yesterday. They didn't reach any agreements on anything because, as he typically does, he didn't offer anything. But the attempts are already on the table, this whole thing about putting labor standards within the WTO, which is going to be very controversial, particularly from the developing countries' point of view, is something that he's bringing up, and that's a response. It doesn't mean that it's a substantive change. It doesn't mean that the whole fundamental issue of how decisions are made and transnational domination of the WTO is going to be changed, but it does mean, and I want to emphasize that the groups, the organizations and activists who are here are going to be smart enough to see through that, but the attempt is going to be made for sure.
I'd like to raise a specific and ask you both to comment on it. World Trade Watch has learned this morning from totally reliable sources that a letter is being sent later today, co-signed by Wei Jingsheng, the Chinese democracy dissident, and U.S. Representative Dennis Kucinich, and they have initiated a letter which will be signed by other members of Congress and other prominent individuals to President Clinton, raising the question of approval of most favored nation status for China in the U.S. Congress and how that may, if it takes place, absolutely remove the last possibility for the U.S. government to prevent China from having essentially veto power over any world effort to safeguard human rights and labor rights and so forth. How might that play out in the months ahead?
Well, the next big battle in the U.S. Congress on the heels of these events in Seattle will be the battle over whether China will get permanent most favored nation trading privileges and become a part of the WTO. And it was very important to have Wei Jingsheng, probably the most prominent of all of the Chinese democracy activists, here in Seattle this week, arguing powerfully that if China is brought into the WTO, the effect will be negative for the Chinese people. It will retard progress toward democracy. It will set back the cause of human rights. It will strengthen the dictatorship. At the same time, Norman, as you just noted, if the Clinton administration were in any way serious about moving the WTO toward addressing labor rights and environmental protections, the last thing they would want to do is bring the Chinese regime into the WTO, because once that regime is in, any hope of reform on those issues will be dead.
Deborah Toler, briefly, how does that strike you?
I don't really have a great deal to add to Scott's comments. I think he's analyzed it quite accurately.
Okay. Well, that is all the time we have for this segment. Thanks to Deborah Toler, the policy analyst for World Trade Watch all week, and we look forward to speaking with you in our wrap-up program tomorrow. And also thanks to Scott Nova of Public Citizen. Up next, the global reach of Cargill.
Trade ministers from around the world gathered here in Seattle are privately discussing a new proposal to put biotechnology on the agenda of the World Trade Organization. Activists say this move is driven by multinational agribusiness lobbies hoping to make massive profits from genetically engineered crops that they've patented. Our special correspondent, Prothap Chatterjee, takes a look at the role of Cargill, one of the largest agricultural corporations in the world.
It's good to see everybody. I missed everybody at NASDAQ.
Police and the National Guard fought pitched battles with protesters on the streets of downtown Seattle at the World Trade Organization Summit, Just about a mile away, agribusiness lobbyists mingled peacefully with foreign delegates and senior officials of the United States Department of Agriculture. The lobbyists were gathered at a forum organized by the Seattle Host Organization, a multinational business-led consortium that is footing the bill for the summit. On hand to thank the businessmen, who had paid top dollar to come to these meetings, was Dan Glickman, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture. Glickman sandwiched his visit between meetings with European ministers whom he is asking to support a U.S. proposal to put biotechnology on the agenda of the free trade body. That proposal is heavily supported by many of the lobbyists at this forum.
I want to thank you all very much for your help, for your involvement. I know there are people here who've been helping USDA and the U.S. Trade Representative's Office through advisory committees. I also know that there are people here from around the world who are representing their own governments, their own companies, and will be most helpful in trying to, not only after this week, but after this week is over, helping us move the agenda towards freer and fairer trade along.
One man who was particularly pleased to see Secretary of Agriculture Glickman was Ernest Mysick, the chairman of Cargill. The company is one of the biggest agribusiness corporations in the world and is heavily invested in biotechnology such as genetically engineered crops.
I have found the administration to be very open to business and particularly to agribusiness. They look for suggestions, they look for input. And not only just from myself or Cargill, but from other companies in various industry sectors. So they definitely are working to improve the trade agenda for the United States. And to the extent that we can contribute something on the ag sector, we're very pleased to be able to do so.
Environmental activists from Cargill's hometown of Minneapolis say that the U.S. administration is more than just helpful to the company. Kristen Dawkins, a director of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, says that the company often works hand in glove with the U.S. administration to advance agribusiness interests in trade talks, such as during the previous round of free trade talks, which began in Uruguay.
The Cargill company had an executive who, in the 1986 Uruguay round, acted as the United States negotiator on the agriculture agreement.
Dawkins says the common goal of the U.S. government and agribusiness companies like Cargill at the WTO summit is to promote the use of untested genetically engineered crops. She said that such crops could pose numerous threats to farmers and the environment.
There are the threats to the farmers, which I would put first and foremost to their ability to make a livelihood and to stay on the land. There are the threats to the ecosystem in terms of the continuity of interspecies ecology and the pollinators in particular. We know about the butterflies, but perhaps more seriously to agriculture, the bees, which are essential for the pollination of maize. The impacts on birds and the rest of the food chain, including, of course, the human beings, the animals that eat the crops. There's unknown results on human and animal health that have yet to be discovered.
Ernest Mysick, the chairman of Cargill, says the genetically engineered crops have been badly misunderstood by the public.
Some of the misunderstandings that we're seeing on the first generation of biotechnology products are not too dissimilar from some of the misunderstandings that we have yet today in world trade. And what we have failed to do, the industry has failed to do, is to do a better job of educating the consumer about the benefits. So far, unfortunately, on biotechnology side, most of the benefits have accrued to the producer or the seed companies, the people who have delivered the first level of technology, which reduces the use of tilling, but also reduces the use of chemicals for insecticides and so forth. And that is not well understood by the consumer. And I think what we have failed to do is we have failed to connect those benefits with the environment.
Mysick has been traveling the world in the last few years to promote genetically engineered crops as well as the export business of his company. He recently traveled with U.S. President Bill Clinton to Africa, and he is a member of the President's Export Council. Food security activists from Africa say that business lobbyists promoting the use of genetically engineered crops are beginning to sprout up in Africa. Gishinge Garango, Food Rights Campaign Coordinator with Action Aid in Kenya.
In limited ways, there are ongoing trials, but mainly limited to the Agricultural Research Institute. Certainly in Kenya, that's the case. But there's also a lot of discussion on the whole question of biotechnology. And in Kenya today, the biotech industries are actually trying to influence our biotechnology agenda within our most significant research institute, which is now going through a phase of privatization. And we actually have now what is being called the biotechnology stakeholders group, which actually brings together researchers, mainly researchers who are sympathetic to the biotechnology cause.
But around the world, governments outside the United States have been extremely skeptical of genetically engineered crops, which face severe restrictions in Europe. Restrictions that the U.S. has challenged in the WTO. This skepticism has spread slowly to other countries like Brazil. Marcos Moraes is the agriculture minister of Brazil.
Well, we in our country haven't yet made a decision on that. We are analyzing and we will announce our policy when we think that technically and scientifically we have exhausted all our program and our research. In Brazil, genetically modified seeds are not being planted.
The restrictions on genetically engineered foods has been slow to spread to the United States, where about half of the soy and corn crops are genetically engineered. Activists say that as long as agricultural giants like Cargill are advising the United States government on trade policy, we are not likely to see any such restrictions soon. For World Trade Watch Radio, I'm Protap Chatterjee in Seattle.
According to many activists gathered in Seattle, the WTO has become the corporation's preferred arena to challenge environmental regulations. Corporations are working with a few powerful governments that are pushing to have environmental restrictions on logging declared a barrier to trade. Joining us now to look at the pending global free logging agreement at the WTO, both from an international and a regional perspective, are Ricardo Carrere of the Uruguay-based World Rainforest Movement and Antonia Yuhas of the American Lands Alliance. Welcome both of you to World Trade Watch. Ricardo, why are the logging interests looking to the WTO in particular to roll back some of the restrictions on logging around the world?
They're in a difficult position, I believe, in the sense that the world has declared that the forests are a very important resource, not only as wood, but as biodiversity, as water resources, as livelihoods for people, etc. And they're being confronted by a growing concern from the public to stop logging. So they need some sort of environment, some sort of place or institution or mechanism to let them go ahead with the power which is behind the governments that are supporting the situation. There are a number of studies all over the place showing that trade, international trade particularly, is a problem to forests, is destroying forests worldwide, not only the tropical forests but also the temperate and boreal forests of the world. So they're in this very difficult situation of having to continue business and increase business while at the same time confronting public opinion and public concern over the fate of the forests.
What impact would a global free logging agreement have in Uruguay and other countries in Latin America?
It depends from country to country, and that's one of the problems of globalization, that it sets out a number of rules which are equal to totally different social and environmental situations. When we speak about the free logging agreement, what we are more concerned with is what's called non-tariff measures, which is a number of instruments that governments do have to avoid deforestation and forest degradation. What this agreement might be was that governments who are willing to log sustainably, for instance, or to extract forest products in a sustainable manner through certification, for example, or through legal regulation at the national level, taking into account the local situations, that would be illegal under the WTO rules. So this means that governments are losing even more control over the use of the resources and putting that that strength, to say in a way, into the hands of the WTO, which is dominated by a number of corporate, very important corporate interests.
Antonia Juhas, I was, and of course you're with the American Lands Alliance. I was very struck by something that was put in a document from Ricardo's organization. It talked about the relationship between export and import and the preservation of forest. And I realized I hadn't actually thought about it quite that way in the question of tariffs and pricing. And could you explain what it means to people who love forests, the way all these tariffs and international deals are arranged?
Mm-hmm. Basically, the use of the tariffs is to, in many cases, restrict the flow of wood products around the world. And a wood product is anything from a log straight out of the ground moving around to a piano. And if you have a tariff wall, for example, Japan has fairly high tariffs on wood products, on certain wood products, you restrict the amount of wood that comes from other countries into your country. It's a tax that gets put on to wood that comes from outside. That way you only use wood from the inside. Less wood is used. For Japan in particular is actually trying to decrease the use of wood overall in their country. They're trying to use other resources, protect the trees that do exist because they know that those trees provide barriers for floods, provide protections for soil, et cetera. They want to maintain their forests, and they want to reduce wood overall, so they don't want wood coming in from outside either. So if you eliminate the tariffs, which what this agreement would do is eliminate all tariffs on wood products worldwide, you eliminate the tariffs, so it's like taking out a tax, you increase the market for the product, you increase consumption and production, and therefore logging, but there are no restrictions for what type of logging would take place. And as multinational timber corporations are moving much more around the world, they're logging in places where it's cheaper to log and there are more ancient forests to be logged. The U.S. government itself did a study of this agreement, and it found that logging would increase in some of the world's most sensitive and biologically rich forests of Malaysia, Indonesia, and Chile.
Antonia, can you give us an update with this? The global free logging agreement is being discussed at this round in Seattle as we speak. We're almost at the end of the week. Can you give us a sense of how likely it is to be approved and what the real impact on the world's forests will be if it is approved?
Yes, there's two pieces to the agreement. It's technically called advanced tariff liberalization, which is a big mouthful, which is why we called it the Global Free Logging Agreement to explain what it would do, which is give timber corporations a free hand to log around the world. Elimination of tariffs and the discussion of non-tariff measures, as Ricardo brought up. The U.S. government is the primary pusher of this agreement. There are other sectors, including forest products, that would be liberalized. Tariffs would be eliminated. It's one of eight sectors. The Clinton administration has said that as of yesterday, if all the governments at the WTO will not agree to sign advanced tariff liberalization by the end of this week, then we will not discuss new issues for the coming round of negotiations. So they've conditioned the entire new round, essentially, on signing this package, which we find amazing that the Clinton administration is so intent on ruining the world's forests that they would condition all other trade agreements on the destruction of our forests. But we only have a few countries that are standing in the way at this point, so the condition is very serious for those who care about forests to convince the Clinton administration to get this off the table because the chances are very high that it could be signed this week.
Well, this is a question then for both of you, just coming after what you said. As a conceptual matter, to what extent are forests resources or nature, and then how does that manifest itself with these very specific questions?
Yeah, one of the problems, I think, is one of the basic problems of this whole process is the WTO and trade ministers in general see the world as human resources and natural resources. They don't see the world as being composed by nature and human beings. We're all resources. And you can see in most country delegations the contradictions between people coming from the environment minister, for example, with the people coming from the trade minister. There are enormous contradictions because they see the world in a totally different manner. So what trade ministers are concerned with is just trade. They're not concerned with the environment. They don't care about nature. They care about trade. While other sectors within government say, at least, express their interest in nature. So this contradiction is permanent, and the biggest problem is that from a hierarchical level, now the WTO has become the top level, while the Biodiversity Convention, the Climate Change Convention, they're all in a lower level, and under all those levels is people and nature.
Basically, there's a lot of money to be made in timber. And in the U.S. in particular, domestic forest activists have made a lot of inroads in restricting the ways that timber corporations can make money off of forests. We consider them to be a natural resource to be protected. They consider them to be a commodity to be traded. And we have put in some very good restrictions. Because we're doing a good job at the domestic level and we're reaching out around the world to try and increase those protections everywhere, the timber corporations have moved to an arena where there is no influence by those who care about the forest. And they are seeking to remove those restrictions that we've put in place. Certification is an excellent example. Certifying that one piece of wood comes from a sustainably harvested forest, another piece of wood comes from an endangered tropical rainforest. This is just educating consumers about the products that they wish to buy. Timber corporations have been trying to use the WTO since its inception to restrict the ability of governments to use this tool. And now they are trying to put it into international law and have it finalized here today.
Briefly, Antonia, we're in the Pacific Northwest, which is timber country. What impact would a global free logging agreement have on this region?
Well, the most important impacts would be all of the domestic protections that we have here. Throughout the Pacific Northwest, for example, there's a ban on the export of raw logs from state forests. There's also a ban of the export of raw logs from federal forests. This is to reduce the overall cut and to protect small local timber mills so that they can use the wood here. The export ban could be thrown out through these negotiations. Down to the smallest town up to the biggest state in the Pacific Northwest have laws on eco-labeling and recycled content of paper. We'll only buy paper that has a certain percentage of recycled content. They'd like to do away with the ability to write laws on recycled content in paper. Green procurement laws will only buy wood that we know comes from a sustainably forested forest. These are all the type of laws that are the favorite of the Pacific Northwest. They could all be wiped out.
Ricardo, in 10 words or less, what should the international response be if, as expected, the free logging agreement is passed?
I think that one of the responses is governments have signed already a large number of international agreements on environment and including forests, such as the Biodiversity Convention, Climate Change Conventions, the Intergovernmental Forum, a panel on forums, proposals for action. They've signed everything. And now they're not taking into account all the things they've already signed. So I think that what we need to tell governments is, look, you need to comply with the things you already agreed upon before beginning to agree on things that are contradictory with those. If you declared in Rio, if you declared after Rio that forests were important, that needed to be conserved as biodiversity, as water, etc., then you have to comply with all those.
Ricardo Carrere is with the Uruguay-based World Rainforest Movement. Antonia Yuhas is with the American Lands Alliance. Thank you both so much for joining us on World Trade Watch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That wraps it up for this edition of World Trade Watch. Special thanks to KUOW and our engineer, Doug Patterson. Our producer is Philip Babich, executive producers Peggy Law and Josh Carliner, associate producer Stephanie Welch. World Trade Watch is a co-production of the National Radio Project, Corporate Watch, and the Institute for Public Accuracy. For more information on this series or a tape or transcript, call 1-800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. With Norman Solomon, I'm Julie Light. Thanks for listening.